The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, John all of a sudden gets reasonable and prudent. Talk about diligence. Jennifer gets off the road and goes for the big bucks and gets them. Roger tries to do a Daniel Webster and spin his way out of death, and succeeds. For now, a new pitch playing with the keys. But will it unlock a fortune? More frauds, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
David, tell me, what's the name of your company? What's your name? What's your position?
My name is David Gerhardema, originally German, and I'm in Hong Kong for the last 9 years. I'm representing Playano Education Limited, which is a Hong Kong-based company. And what we basically do is we are an app development and an app publishing house. So we have developed several apps, of which Piano Hero is our flagship. Now, Piano Hero is an app which...
All right. So yeah. You've already spent like 35 seconds too long. So let's keep it really simple, right? So you're an education company.
Yeah.
And you're building what, immersive education applications? Is that right?
That's right.
And are you building this to sell them yourself, or do you build them for other people?
Yeah, so for other people, obviously, yeah.
You're a game studio, or what are you?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. And we built basically previously B2C, but now we're going slowly B2B2C, which is go through companies to their students as well.
Okay, and so it's for education, which is this like for educational institutions like bachelor's, master's, PhD, high school, or is this for corporate education or who?
Very good question. K-12, a lot of young people are learning to play the piano the first time in their life, typically. And then at some point when they're older, they start craving to play the piano again or are new learners. And these two are basically our major target groups, which is K-12 and like older people who want to get
right, into. So you don't just teach people to play the piano, right?
Actually, we do. We really focus.
This is only piano education.
So our core app is, yeah. So with each product, you need to focus really on its sole purpose. And our first app is focusing solely on piano. And we have built apps for other target groups, for other purposes, and we will continue to do that for many educational reasons. We have many ideas of where we can use immersive ways to
So let's talk about piano. What's the number of young students that want to learn how to play piano in the world?
The number of young students? I don't know.
Your target audience, right?
Yeah. So typically, children start on average at the age of 5 to learn piano, in China even at 4, or Hong Kong as well. And then usually they drop off at like around 18 years. And that's obviously...
How many of them are there out there?
As I said, like, I don't know the demographics. We have 8 billion people on this planet. How many are between 5 and 18 years? I got to guess at this point, I need to calculate that to give you the real answer.
Oh, that's all right. Don't calculate it now. I was just wondering. So, all right. So you have all those kids, but not all those kids are on the internet or able to have an app or a phone or anything like that. So it's considerably fewer. When I looked at your Gee Whiz, the total addressable market that you indicated was something like $508 million, right?
Right. Yes.
Okay. So
it's not going to become a $100 billion company under any circumstance, right?
A billion would be all right, which is a unicorn. That's my next goal for sure.
I understand, but you're not going to get bigger than the total addressable market. So
that's right.
So let's talk about the technology. This is the Cyber Show, and we want to understand the cyber technology. Lots of people have different things that help you play piano. In fact, you can go download for free something where you push the buttons and it acts like a piano. Well, it's a little bit small if it's on your cell phone. So what makes yours different from all the other free stuff or, $1.95 forever stuff?
Yeah. So first of all, within our target group, we have, people who use their real piano. Yeah. We call this real piano mode. Yeah. Then the second game mode we offer is a virtual piano, which is what you just described, which is basically a virtual piano which you play on your screen. And the third game mode we will provide in a very close future is to play virtually on your tabletop. Yeah, let's call it tabletop piano.
Oh, so you'll see where my fingers are.
That's right.
Okay. So let's go back to the first one, the real piano. So real piano, do you need an interface to the piano or you just listen to the piano on the app and then figure out what they're doing?
Yeah, so the real problem we are solving is that if you want to play the piano instrument, you will need to know music sheet notation. And we are literally the first and only mobile app which solves this on an extremely scalable way.
So when you say that, so are you putting notes, because the way the staff works, you can only put so many notes on my phone. I mean, it's only so wide and so high. You might have two lines that are short lines of music is all you can fit, right?
Well, the thing is, you always have like, basically one hand, right? So you're playing up to five notes with your right hand and up to five notes with your left hand. So that's kind of like our angle. And typical education starts always with playing one hand separately because it's just simply too difficult to play both hands at the very, very start. So we focus on enjoyment, which is allowing you directly to play your instrument without the prerequisite of knowing any music sheet notation, which is a big, big consumer hurdle. And for us, we're just taking the typical MIDI format, which is a standardized audio format, and project this immersively on your piano by putting an overlay in augmented reality or extended reality onto your piano. So that means you don't need any Oculus Quest $1,000 worth AR VR glasses, or you don't need any Apple Vision Pro $3,000.
I understand. So when you say you're making a game out of it, how is it a game?
Well, you're basically following the tiles to play. It's kind of like Guitar Hero style.
Okay, so you're showing me on the screen how to move my fingers, and I just move my fingers to make the sounds. Oh, okay. So
that's right.
That's pretty interesting. So I'm looking at the screen right above my fingers, and it just tells push here, and I get the right tune out if I just push the right button.
Yes.
Oh, well, when I learned to play piano long, long, long ago, well, I didn't really learn how to play piano very well. For one thing, nobody told me about the one hand at a time. So we were confused.
Really?
But there are plenty of other aspects to my confusion about playing piano. And so I not only never got any good at it, I didn't get sufficiently good to convince my parents to not move me to another instrument. So I always wanted to play trumpet.
Right.
But for one reason or another, my parents thought that was too loud. Right. Although I did try it for a while. And then we moved to violin, and I was never any good at violin either. So eventually I became a singer in a rock and roll band, which was not a successful band. Do you think that that's not talking about me, but more generally, do you think that most students that end up walking away from the piano walk away because it's not fun or because they can't play? It's all about fun.
It's all about fun as always, right? But it's all about also, it's just your bother, right? It's the same with books versus movies. I personally love reading. I read a lot, but I do believe that a lot of people don't read simply because they're bothered by how the reading process works. So they end up watching movies instead, right? So, I mean, look at Netflix, how crazy they are shooting through the roof. And we're basically dealing with the same thing. So I do believe that nobody really wants to read music sheet notation, but everybody just wants to play an instrument. And that's with young children in particular, even crazier for older people.
Yeah, because, I was going to say, you know, as an adult, I can use the game too. Right? Because, you know, I really would like to be able to make nice sounds. You know, it's just that when I actually
That's what we're doing.
It sounds bad because, you know, it's always, I'll get two or three notes and then the fourth note will be sour.
Yeah.
Because I don't have any guidance and I'm just trying to figure out which one of these keys it is.
Yeah. So even like, look at yourself. Like I was exactly the same like you. Yeah. So I played 3 years piano when I was younger. I think I stopped at the age of 14, 15 because I got interested in women and soccer as everyone. And so the first year I really spent like learning music sheet notation. The second and third year, I basically just said to my teacher, hey, can't I just play one song? And I literally spent like 2 years trying to play one song, which was Für Elise from Beethoven. Everybody knows the song.
Yeah.
And I tell you, that was the first song I uploaded onto the app when I got my first prototype. And I immediately played it. It was the first time in my whole life where I played the whole song through. Yeah.
And see, I learned to read music. I can read it just fine. I just can't play it.
Yeah. So that's why these two educational parts of like reading music and playing an instrument are two completely different parts. And we focus solely.
It turns out when my kids took music lessons, they were never given the sheet music. They were just taught to play the music. And my son got very good at it. Everybody else was fine at it. So I think, you know, maybe you're onto something here.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Just pull a double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their gee whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. A cyber attack has disrupted hospital computer systems across the United States, forcing emergency rooms in several states to close on Thursday and ambulances to be diverted. This began Thursday at facilities operated by based in. And when the attack ends, you'll know because you won't die if you get in an accident. And that's breaking news on the Cyber Show.
How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. The creation and distribution of false information has recently spiked, and is likely to continue to get worse because of generative AI. As an example, here are two short pieces, one from a legitimate news organization by a real reporter reporting in real time, and the other generated by an online platform asked to write a short story on the same topic, but with minor changes. Or maybe not so minor. Here's the first one.
Cyber attack disrupts healthcare system services in several states. A California-based healthcare system faced a cyber attack this week, shutting down some services at affiliated locations and forcing some to rely on paper records. In an emailed statement to the newspaper, the healthcare system confirmed the attack has disrupted our operations, and said its offices were in touch with the FBI and third-party cybersecurity specialists. Upon learning of this, we took our systems offline to protect them and launched an investigation, the statement said. This incident is a firm reminder that cybersecurity threats pose a real risk for healthcare organizations across the nation. Emergency rooms for two hospitals in the network diverted patients Thursday. While our investigation continues, the statement reads, "We are focused on addressing the pressing needs of our patients, as we work diligently to return to normal operations as quickly as possible."
Here's the second one.
New York-based health system hit by cyber attack, people die. A New York-based health system was hit by a cyber attack on Thursday, forcing the system to shut down some of its services and rely on paper records. As a result of the attack, the system was forced to cancel some elective surgeries and divert ambulances to other hospitals. In addition, the attack caused the system to deliver incorrect medical doses to some patients. This resulted in the deaths of at least two patients. The health system said that it is working with law enforcement and cybersecurity experts to investigate the attack. The system has also taken steps to secure its computer systems and protect patient information. In a statement, the health system said that it is committed to protecting the privacy and security of our patients' information, but it is working around the clock to restore its computer systems and resume normal operations. The health system is offering free credit monitoring to patients who may have been affected by the attack.
Which one is the real story? Good question. One of the newest frauds on the internet today is a multi-step process. It starts with an initial contact offering something you want or need for your job. Then as you start to communicate, you get a link or a file emailed to you, chatted to you, texted to you, or connected to you through a social media application. When you open this file or click on the link, it displays a message indicating that it was corrupted and could not be opened. But in reality, it contains malicious code that merely displays that message and leaves a Trojan horse on your computer. Once that Trojan horse is in place, the attacker is in your system and expands their access to perform any of a number of malicious acts, typically ranging from extortion, this is often in the form of ransomware, to financial theft, for example, by altering banking information on an invoice. What can you do about it? Well, there's nothing much you can really do to prevent this sort of deception from working. The reason is that if you don't use the internet to get in touch with people in order to get your job done, you're likely not to be able to get the job done. But when you encounter the situation, you can recognize this scenario. And if you do, you can immediately contact whoever's in charge of cybersecurity and have them fix the problem before it gets worse. In the meanwhile, try and be safe out there, but don't imagine you're going to be perfect against modern threats. The cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields. Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security.
That effort comes at a price. All security comes at a price, and everyone focuses on the dollars and cents of the cost. But frankly, the no's from the command level usually are not because of dollars and cents. That's the excuse they use, but it comes from opinions.
So let's then talk about that. Generally goes into what we call risk management, and which is to say you can accept risks, and mostly they do. And the reason is, you know, an insider risk. I can't be questioning everybody on my team. If I don't trust the people on my team, I can't effectively operate. That's the standard high-level insider threat issue, right?
Yep.
And that's where I guess studies seem to indicate that the I think it was like 80% of the actual losses involve an insider, according to the old research and so forth. So the insider threat, if it's somebody who's low level within the organization, they don't have a problem with firing them or doing other things like that. But if it's high up, once you get above a certain threshold, they just cannot tolerate emotionally just trusting each other.
Yeah, and that's why oftentimes you find these layers. When I evaluate insider threat programs, I can't remember one where I didn't find some layering effect as to how the program applied. For an example, an executive in a privately held company who is chairman of the board, owner, whatever you want to call him, is he an insider threat? Of course he is. He can bring the company down in a single decision. Yeah. Well, but again, if he owns the company,
well, then it's his money.
Shareholders, it turns into a financial evaluation.
No, look, so if you own it, you have the right to make bad decisions. But for a public company, the chairman of the board is not the owner.
Entirely different story. There are fiduciary laws that require publicly held companies. And in some states, there's even fiduciary laws that require the officers of a privately held corporation to meet certain standards.
So if there are more than one shareholder, yeah. But so there's reasonable and prudent, right? The problem comes down here to what's reasonable and prudent. In the cyber arena, we don't have a common agreement on what the words mean. We don't have a common agreement on what's reasonable and prudent. The legal standard is relatively clear, but that doesn't translate into specific decisions. And all of the sort of the standards that you see out there, I'll leave mine out of it, but most of the standards you see out there, they say you should have a process in place, but they don't tell you how to make decisions.
One of the most common mistakes in citing law is what you just did.
Oh, that's me.
Reasonable and prudent, right? That's not the entire statement. The legal statement is reasonable and prudent under the circumstances.
So the definition of reasonable and prudent, when you look into it, has to do with the circumstances. It has to do with what a reasonable person would do under similar circumstances, but it also has to do with diligence, right? You have to have a level of diligence commensurate with the consequence and so forth. So I wasn't leaving it out. It's just a one level deeper in the description.
Yeah, but when the judge rules on that, on a reasonable and prudent, he will always add that. So if it's a negative decision, he'll say it wasn't reasonable and prudent under the circumstances.
Right. So the question of what constitutes reasonable and what constitutes prudent, you're supposed to have somebody with expertise, right? And the person with expertise looking at the history of similar decisions in the similar circumstances and being aware of the world around them is justifying the decision and explaining it and documenting it. And this is one of the big problems. You know, we try to provide documentation for decision making, and a lot of executives do not want to document the basis for their decision because, you know, they feel that that induces liability. They're going to get questioned in arrears saying, well, why did you think this? And if they said, well, here's why, and they looked it up and they did enough of this, somebody's going to say, well, you didn't see this, you didn't see that, right? So they don't want to document. But I think failure to document is probably a basis for saying you didn't have adequate information to call it a reasonable and prudent decision.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that.
What has happened here? You have not decided not to disagree with me on something.
No, I don't. I haven't disagreed with you more than a dozen times today. And most of those are benign. So
I'm going to rip directly on that and say the word prudent is enough. Because prudent, I would think, and I'll take John's word on the legal definition. I'll remember that if I'm ever in court for these purposes. But, you know, prudent, in turn, you know, if it's not reasonable and if it's not in regards to the context, then obviously it can't be prudent. Right. Prudent, you know, standing on the surface of the sun and prudent, you know, sitting in your living room or anyway.
So it can be prudent, but unreasonable. The way I try to characterize this, which is probably not the best characterization from a legal standpoint, is I look at prudent as something that any prudent person would do. Right. It's the minimum that you have to do. And I look at, so if you're imprudent, you're not doing enough. If you're being unreasonable, you're doing too much. So I think of prudent as the bottom and reasonable, unreasonable as the top of the range.
Unreasonable is more active. You know,
I tried to reconcile these definitions through looking at legal literature and so forth. And so I sort of think reasonable and prudent means, you know, enough, but not too much.
Right.
And if you look at cybersecurity and most other things, right, the classic, you know, curve that they talk about for optimization is, well, if you don't do any cybersecurity, you'll go out of business because somebody will attack you right away and you'll just get wiped out. If you do too much cybersecurity, you'll spend all your money on it. You'll get wiped out because you won't have any money left. So we know the ends. We know if you don't do any, or if you do all, nothing but, you're going to lose. But there's no idea what the curve looks like in the middle.
Right.
So how do you get to the middle, right? And the answer is expertise. And in the legal definitions of reasonable and prudent, when you look through this, they talk about person who is an expert, and the definition of an expert in the legal world of the United States is knowledge, skills, training, education, and experience, more than the average person or the person on the jury or the judge, right? So somebody that can give you information that's more probative than prejudicial, which is part of the legal framework, right? So, and I'm not a lawyer, so check
but
with
you. You do play one on TV.
I don't play one on TV or on the radio. So the challenge here in cybersecurity is that people don't engage experts. They, you know, have some, my cousin Billy Bob or somebody I know or somebody that shows up at the door, and they don't engage sufficient quality experts for the consequences. Because remember, if the consequences are low, you know, it's reasonable.
Bob, Billy Bob, fine. Yes.
Yeah. You can do too much or too little. It's up to you, right? But as the consequences go up, the expertise has to go up commensurate with that. And people don't recognize that. They don't. And there's another completely different problem in the space. And that is the only way to identify an expert is by having another expert identify them to you. So how can you tell if they're an expert? Well, the courts settle this by knowledge, skills, training, education, and experience. So when you go into court to testify, you describe those things. It's in your report. And it's in the voir dire before you get admitted to opine as an expert. So, and judges, judges, you know, typically have law degrees, which means graduate school. So they're going to say, if you're going to be an expert, you're going to have good education, but you don't need any education if you've been doing it for 35 years and, you know, you've published papers on it and you teach other people how to do it. Because guess what? It's a combination. So, right. So that's what they're looking. Somebody that knows more than you know. One of the problems in business is that especially top executives have a tendency to believe that nobody knows more than they know. And then part two is if they have a CISO that works for them, they hired them because they're supposedly experts. So, you know, I'm sorry, I already have my experts. And they said, it's all right to do blah, blah, blah. I say, okay, well, it's up to you. And then, you know, the next day they get wiped out because of the thing you identified, and then they get a shareholder lawsuit, and then they could be personally liable. But guess what? All the companies we deal with are still in business, or they couldn't deal with us.
Right.
So they haven't failed yet. And so they're probably doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, which is, you know, it's always one of my first lines when you're talking to someone about their security, right? You know, I emphasize the fact that the fact that I'm sitting here talking to you about your security means you've done it right so far. You know, that you know, congratulations, you win, right? You know, so far.
The phrase is not dead yet.
Right, not dead yet. And all that money you didn't spend on security in the past. I mean, if you're not talking to me about, you know, recovering from a massive attack, you know, then apparently that was the right choice, right? Even if it was a good idea to buy that stuff and everything else, right? You keep making decisions. You're going in the right direction. Your organization's working. Let's make it better. Right.
So there was a discussion on LinkedIn where people are oohing and aahing about this company that got like a couple hundred thousand dollar fine for over the last 15 years paying no attention to cybersecurity. You know, whatever the fine, maybe it was $150,000 fine, you name it. But so they got this fine and these people are criticizing the company. And, you know, I pointed out, excuse me, the cost of cybersecurity over the last 15 years probably would have been at least 10 times as much as the fine. So, right.
You know, so they said that on
they actually made a good business decision,
right?
By ignoring it, and okay. And the problem is the fine. If the fine was 50 times as much, okay, now it would have been a bad business decision,
right? Well, it takes us back to our risk and consequence conversations, but you know, like you know, Heartland Payment Systems when they got that huge attack, and their stock price went down $500 million in a couple hours. It came back.
Yeah, 6 months later was back up. I was actually called in on that case.
I was giving a seminar on PCI and the SIM. We basically exactly what their problem was, and we pulled up their stock price and watched it go down in this 4-hour session, and it was the consequence of the fact at that time that you could be PCI compliant, you could be doing what you're told to do, and still be massively vulnerable and not be able to detect it for 6 months.
Oh, but it's much worse than that. So they got a PCI compliance audit by an authorized PCI compliance auditor that said they were good to go.
Right.
Within just very, short period of time before the bad thing happened.
Right.
And then PCI comes in and fines them.
Right.
And I'm like, guys, what do you mean? They followed, and they did it. They followed every requirement of PCI. They did everything that the PCI said you have to do. It was audited to verify they did it. The fact is, it was PCI's fault for not being clear in their guidance and for not, being adequate, to make it reasonable and prudent if you did what they said.
Right. And this is about 20 years ago when security information management, SIM, was becoming a thing. This is why I was giving that talk on that training or whatever it was, the day it happened, right? And PCI, the compliance at that point, didn't, it said you had, I think it was 6-month audits, right? And they, like you said, they just had an audit. But for 6 months, you could break through, for 6 months, detect was not part of PCI. He had no need, no requirement to actually have a SIM or something in place where you could say, huh, look at all that funky traffic. Because all of right, the SIM, so anyways.
SIM security incident event management. They always do that.
I know. E couldn't be there.
Well, one way or the other. But the other thing about that is the attack did not happen after the audit. The attack was prior to the audit. The audit looked at their systems after it was under attack when the attack was already successfully executing and didn't find it.
Right.
So the audit process didn't detect what was going on, and that is part of detect, right? So guess what? They actually have a detection process in place. It didn't detect it. And you cannot be perfect, right? So the stock market brutality is a different thing than the fine. The fine was ridiculous. Here's the deal. You can't drive more than 50 miles an hour. Okay, you were driving 45 miles an hour. You got in an accident. We're going to give you a ticket for speeding. I'm sorry.
Right.
I was not speeding. Which brings us to your early life court case, which you got to tell us about.
Yeah, so in South Carolina, I'm riding a motorcycle because I'm young and broke and so forth. I'm landscaping at Greenville Tech, taking classes at night. And on a country road, and I'm riding behind this pickup truck, looking at the, solid double line right next to me, and it turns into a dash line, which means I can pass. So I pull out to pass, and I pull up next to this truck, and, he turns left on top of me because it was a left turn. And I looked up the policy at the time, and so I got a ticket for passing too close to within 150 feet of an intersection. And I went back and measured the dash line. It was under 150 feet. The state installed indications of ability to pass or not were actually all illegal. You couldn't actually use them legally. And, there was a line of bushes and so forth. So I put together this whole presentation, went into court and, did not succeed in getting my ticket turned over, and asked the judge, does this mean if the state, puts lines on the highway that go straight into a brick wall and I hit the brick wall, it's my fault? I said, yes. So policy is just a fascinating thing. So I was underneath the pickup truck on my motorcycle, but I had all my safety gear on. I had shorts, flip-flops, and sunglasses. So it was perfect.
All right. So hang on. There's another case. I think it was it hazardous driving or driving beyond conditions?
Yes. Yeah, a Honda Civic with one tire had got blown out or something, so we'd replaced it. The perfect tire on one side, the other three tires could all use to be replaced, and one of them picked up a screw, so now it's going flat. And doing 20 miles an hour on another windy little South Carolina road, accelerating when somebody turned from 20 to 30 miles an hour in a 45 zone, under the speed limit, on a perfectly sunny day that had rained like heck the day before and was draining down a hill. And there was a block culvert, which just over the rise, which I couldn't see, there was a little flood of water. And I went through that, spun out, hit a tree, called the police, being a good citizen. I should report this. It was an accident, young guy. And I get a ticket for driving too fast for conditions. And fought that one in court, too. And it's great, older, at least from a 22-year-old perspective, older judge leaned down and she looked straight at me after my elaborate arguments and how could you possibly predict this. And she said, if you get in an accident, you are. driving too fast for conditions. No, not turned over. Pay the fine. That's actually true. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's actually a sensible ruling, right?
Like
the definition of too fast for conditions is you got an accident.
That's right. You could be walking. You got an accident. It was too fast
for conditions. You ran into the wall. Okay. You couldn't see it. It was your excuse. Well, guess what? Yeah. You can't go that fast. It's like the old joke, right? You know, doctor, it hurts when I do, you know, such and such. Well, don't do such and such. Oh.
Roger Royce is one of the most well-known and well-positioned attorneys working on cyber issues, particularly in the ag tech arena, but also in many other areas. He also has a tremendous understanding of influence and related issues, as we'll see in our discussions.
Welcome back, Roger. Last time we were talking about your influence operations, and I wanted to talk about that because it's fascinating that you view being a lawyer as being somebody who is using influence tactics to get, I guess, really to mutual understanding and beneficial things for all parties, right?
That's right. That's right. Well, yeah. I mean, persuasion, you mentioned it earlier. I mean, you studied this yourself. Persuasion gets kind of a bad reputation. It's like you're coercing somebody into doing something they don't want to do. That's not what we do. Not at all. Persuasion is getting to that meeting of the minds that you describe. It's really letting the parties understand what the optimal negotiated result is, because there usually is a path, you know, and our job is to find that path.
So let's talk about influence operations in context. You know that today on a global basis, you know, cyber systems are being used for influence operations, that, you know, we have all these operations that are running in you know, internet chat rooms and social media and so forth. And we see it all over the media. And, mm-hmm. and this is, you know, it's politics is all about influence and so forth. So your expertise in influence, have you ever looked at it in that context and applied it to cause that sort of social influence?
Well, defensively, I mean, if you're saying there's a dark side to this, there certainly is. And I think that's why it's good to be aware of when you're being influenced or when you're being persuaded or when you see these tools and tricks being applied out there. And it is regularly done. I mean, there's patterns. There's absolute patterns that you applied across industries, across sectors, across businesses. And it's helpful when you recognize them, because that's when you know you're being sold. That might not be a bad thing. You know, it might be something you really need. On the other hand, I think you're talking about some of the more pernicious uses.
Well, it's used for crimes, right? But it's also used, you know, for convincing you to, you know, get the medicine you need so you don't die, right? And there are people on all sides of those things, right?
Well, absolutely. So let me give you an example. I don't know, this may be too personal for your radio show, but...
No, there's no such thing. Tell us.
All right, so I recently had some medical issues, and it was about a year ago that I was persuaded, I was influenced. I read about a early cancer detection test. Now, it is so unlikely that I would have cancer that the insurance company won't even pay for that, right? I work out every day, I have a plant-based whole food diet, I meditate, I do everything right. It is so unlikely. But you know, I was persuaded when I read the marketing materials, and I was persuaded by the idea that there's an extremely small risk that I have any cancer markers, but the consequences would be tremendous. So I took the test. Turns out I had pancreatic cancer. All right.
And the diagnosis was correct. It wasn't a false positive.
Diagnosis was correct. All right.
Wow, because that's a, you know, formerly a death sentence. I mean, that's what killed my father.
Yeah, and I've had a couple of doctors tell me that it is still a death sentence, but I've got some scientists who say that not so fast. We caught this early. So I've been through 6 months of chemo, so I don't have any hair. I've had surgery, and I'm heading off to another country in a few weeks to get a vaccine. But had it not been for me being persuaded to take that test, I would not be here right now. Okay.
I just want to point out that I increasingly have no hair, and that has nothing to do with chemotherapy.
Well, that's okay. That's good.
So yeah, you can't remove a pancreas, right? So the, you know, the old surgical saying, when in doubt, cut it out. Right?
Yeah.
So that's, yeah, it's fantastic that you're, you know, handling this, you know, so well, because that's a tremendous challenge. So, but that's a really good job of, you know, influence operations being used to convince somebody to do something that turned out to be right. But this is just a chance of being right, right? There's the major, you know, almost certainly it was not going to come out positive. You just got really, really lucky, right?
I am very lucky, but how many other people out there, you know, need to get lucky? They need to be persuaded to do this. And this is a little bit off topic, but I mean, and we have a medical system. My doctor did everything he did to talk me out of taking this test. Doesn't work, doesn't exist, don't do it. False positives, just a waste of money, waste of time. He refused to prescribe it. I needed a doctor's prescription. He just flat out refused. And it took me forever to find, you know, I had to find a different network doctor to do it. So I needed a lot of persuading. And it's a good thing, because there were dark persuaders out there too, who are doing their best to kill me.
Yeah, the medical space is a great analog for the cyberspace, right? You know, and my grandmother Minnie Gay was born as the youngest of 9 sharecroppers' children at the turn of the last century in the Florida Panhandle. As you said in the discussion there, you know, when the doctor showed up, if there was a doctor, that doctor knew everything on earth about medicine, effectively, right? There's, you know, there's no other resource, there's no other source. You know, they will tell you the thing. In the late 1900s and the early 2000s, with both one of my dearest friends and my wife, both went into situations that where the system is less intelligent, you know, less knowledgeable than I am, you know, where just literally getting online, you know, identifying things, talking to the key person at Johns Hopkins University by, you know, 8:30 the next morning before you get your next meeting with the oncologist and saying, you know what, there's this thing that will genetically edit, you know, the leukemia in my friend's bones. And it works, right? So it's not, you know, as we go through these things along the way that actually matter in our lives, we need to understand where on these curves we are, right? We are coming from, in living memory, from a medical expert, the one you may or may not see, because you probably won't see one, but if you do be one, they'll know everything, to this world that's in the future. This, we're not there yet, where there's so much information and the professionals, much less the customers, the patients, can actually see it well enough at the same time to make good decisions.
Right. So for one thing, the total knowledge of all of medicine, you know, 100 years ago was way less than it is today. So you can't expect that they're going to know that much, right? So specialization, further and further specialization, to the point where if you have this very specific thing, there's maybe 10 or 20 places in the world that actually deal with it. And maybe there's only one researcher who's even looked at it and is starting to look at the possibilities. So that's, you know, sort of problem one. But the other side of that is, you know, this is where computers come into play. So what's supposed to happen is the doctor's not supposed to be like Dr. House, right? Which is, you know, who almost kills everybody he ever sees, right? They almost all die until he saves them, and every once in a while one of them doesn't quite get saved. But what they, you know, they should be able to use computers, put in the symptoms. Remember, I mean, there was a computer that did better than doctors at diagnosing, you know, lots of conditions. You know, when AI started with recursive descent, you know, way back, and certainly this was true in the 1970s.
A quick note here, Mycin, M-Y-C-I-N, was developed over about 5 or 6 years in the early 1970s at Stanford University. It was written in Lisp, and it was the subject of the doctoral dissertation of Edward Shortlife.
And into the 80s. There should be AI at this point, not ChatGPT, wild guess at it, you know, random crap AI, but AI that's done enough statistical analysis and correlation, and it's had the doctors go through and look at it and see, aha, that's right, that's why, and so forth. Plus the learning, right? All that combined, plus the post-execution, right? So you do the operation and you take out the thing and you send the sample off to the lab and it says it was this, and you feed that back into the system. It should be that we have a system to that point where it can diagnose pretty quickly and know what's going on. And the other side of it that Roger was talking about
is the, you have a chance of getting this disease. Let's stop it from happening in the first place.
Right.
That too should be part of that system. That's something where the cyber world can change the world as we know it and should. And,
right.
And lots of people are trying to do so. And this is one of the reasons people might live to be, you know, 140 or so on average when our children's children go through the system. I mean, right. It probably won't save us.
Well, exactly. Right. You know, I think, you know, I'm a big believer in medical immortality or longevity, right? You know, at some point in the future, you know, the kid, I'm thinking, hey, I'm going to live, that'll happen in my lifetime. I don't think it will, right? You know, who knows? But so just take it academically and just dispassionately. And is the human biological system infinite? You know, are there an endless, you know, number of systems and devices and mechanisms inside the human biological system, or is it finite? If it's finite, and it is, we will someday have figured it all out. Yeah, you know, maybe 1,000 years from now, maybe 100, who cares when?
Being a little bit careful, it might be finite in terms of its total size, but it might be infinitesimal because we live in a continuous universe, right?
Right.
But even if it's, you know, a not infinitesimal universe, even if we can only go down to the level of the atom, not even the particles within the atom, even if it only goes down to the level of atom, there's so many of it that it might as well be infinite in terms of, you know, anything we can reasonably do with it.
Right. But again, you know, there's only so many organs in the body. There's only so many variations of functional. Anyways, my point is
the alternatives out of it is you take samples, DNA sample, you know, from early on, and they're doing that already. And then you just automatically generate a replacement for that organ that's fresh.
Right.
And you do the replacement. Right. Or the thing they can now, you know, grow various kinds of bones. So maybe you grow your tooth in place instead of getting that replacement tooth put in. They put in the seed and a tooth grows. Now you have the baby tooth first, of course. You have to have a little one that comes out and you have to cry because that's part of the process. Right.
It is.
Tuesday, August 15th, we have the Go to Angel Free for All. Once a year, presenters can present for free. Unfortunately, it's too late to sign up, but we hope to have their presentations available on the Cyber Show in the coming weeks.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking here with Jennifer Bayuk. Jennifer was one of the first chief information security officers on Wall Street and has a long and storied career before and after that.
Okay, so we're here talking with Jennifer again, and this time, you know, we've been talking about, you know, how much you can lose and how much you can break in and about all the red teaming and such that she did. So after that, so you're working for the big accounting firm doing that. So then you made another transition. So what did you do next and why did you do it?
Well, I was traveling almost 100% of the time, like going to the West Coast for a week and then to, you know, Europe for a week and, you know, just all over the place. And I had just gotten married and my husband got cancer. It was like, I have to stop traveling now. That was it. So I went to falling back on my friends at AT&T that had just broken up. I was able to go to one of the companies.
It's not your friends that broke up. It's AT&T that was broken.
Yeah, the friends, okay. They were all so friends. Now, AT&T broke up into three companies very early on, you know, NCR, AT&T, Lucid. So those were the three. What happened a little later, though, as the divestiture continued, is that all of the loans and leases that AT&T had been giving to their customers over the years was still sitting somewhere in headquarters to be divvied up. And they decided to take a couple of people from headquarters, from the chief financial officer's office, and just create a whole new company to be AT&T Capital Corporation, which owned all those loans and leases, had 9 processing centers globally, different continents.
Just all the money, right?
All the money. And
okay. Well, that's a good idea. We'll break up the company. We'll just keep all the money.
Yeah. Their job was to securitize themselves out of business, which means turn all those loans and leases into securities and sell them to somewhere. And then sell the frame of the operations to somebody who needed it.
Yeah. So and then you're returning all the money to the shareholders, right?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Okay, so you can get a percentage.
Well, AT&T, I am sure that the president, vice president, or whatever, were paid in percentages. I got an annual bonus, which I hadn't been, you know, which is still better because it was in the financial industry than being at Pricewaterhouse. So, as you say, I went incrementally up. My peers may have been doing better, but I was happy with that job because it was like 20 minutes from home. I was auditing. I did travel maybe once a month, but it was to an interesting place like Hong Kong. You know, it was
okay. Yeah, visit one of those worldwide data centers and enjoy the local fare. Yes.
Right. Unfortunately, they were very good at what they did, and they securitized themselves out of business in a couple of years. So I was looking around to make sure I wasn't the last person on the ship. And I got recruited into Wall Street to be a security architect at the dawn of their e-commerce, you know, expansions.
But you didn't work for Wall Street. Who did you work for?
At Bear Stearns.
Bear Stearns. Okay.
Right.
So just
there's an ominous call right there.
We're going to take a pause and continue this in our next session. Talk about fun.
Right. I love the Coca-Cola reference, right? You know, and the flavors and fragrances. You know, there are historically businesses that really do have that are just, you know, the seven, you know, the Colonel's, you know, secret sauce, and generally do have, you know, really good protective practices around that. They didn't necessarily translate to computers, but there's still lessons to learn, I think.
I worked on a gig where there was some very important stuff that certainly the trade secret was extremely important for a wide variety of reasons. And, you know, it's not the problem isn't that they don't try and they don't want to do it. It's that they don't want an independent review by somebody that thinks outside of their box. So things are verticalized, right? So the cyber person looks at the computers and these things, and the physical person looks at these other things and so forth. What we found in this particular case, among many other things, was that there were public relations photographs. And you could look at the public relations photographs and you would see the magic information. It was like, oh, there it is. Well, you know, and when I walked through the facility, I told them, you know, before I go in, cover up anything. And they said, oh, we don't normally do that. That's all right. Do it so I don't have to see it, because I don't want to, you know, I don't want somebody to put a gun to my head and say, what was that number you saw above that, and have to try and remember the number, which I wasn't going to remember anyway. But mostly they just don't understand the implications. They don't understand the puzzle problem where you put things together from different parts. And if they understand it, they're always looking at it from their insider point of view. And so just a matter of perspective always helps. But Jennifer's career here is, you know, fantastic. This is a rocket to the moon, but underpaid.
as often happens, right? You know, and the gender disparity, you know, issue is still a problem, right? You know, it's, you know, and it bears saying, you know, among the best of us, certainly, you know, a lot of the women are the best, most diligent, hardest working, smartest, had to fight the hardest, right? And actually should get paid more than me. But, yeah, I think
nobody should get paid more than me. But but if that was true, then we would have a really failed society. So, sorry, somebody has to get paid more than me so they can pay me a portion of it, right?
Right. But and like in some of these conversations, Jennifer's path and all our friends and everybody we've talked about on this show, you know, follows the same evolution. Right. And we haven't, I don't know if we've talked casinos. I mean, my experience, as I think about different sectors, I've enjoyed working with the casinos, you know, over the decades from time to time, because there's folks who really get security and get all the aspects of it and get it all the time, because.
And they're being ripped off all the time. People are always trying to.
Right. Yeah. That's right. So you know. And I'd have to go, you know, I'm not speaking on behalf of my professional opinion right now, but I'll bet they have a bet about the best cybersecurity on earth. You know, they've always had the right attitude towards it.
Oh, well, I don't know about that, but but I wouldn't gamble against the house. Let's just say it that way.
Yes, that's right.
They do. They tend to cheat relative to the world that we live in, right? So one of the things about casinos is people do end up, you know, having body parts removed and so forth when they break the rules. And we're not allowed to do that sort of stuff, right? So I'm in the kindler, gentler. The other side of it is, you know, you can look at it as casinos themselves just being crooks anyway. I mean, they are taking advantage of people's weakness. And notice, for the most part, casinos have smoking and drinking and gambling together.
That's right.
So the people, you know, they're getting people drunk. They're people that are sort of, you know, don't really care about the potential of dying of cigarettes and so forth. Present company accepted. But, you know, and so that's part of what they're doing. They're exploiting those people to advantage.
Well, in all of our, you know, as I look at, you know, my advising, you know, what do I advise people to do? I guess I'm always thinking of, you know, I have these different legs. You know, there's the industrial control system space, the operational technology space. We've been building aqueducts and so forth for thousands and thousands of years, learn a lot of lessons there. In supply chain now, you know, these days, hot topic in the cyber world. Well, people have been taking a great deal of responsibility for exactly what's in that box and on that pallet and in that truck for, again, thousands of years, you know, highly developed for hundreds of years. And, you know, Coca-Cola, you know, we get, you know, everybody likes to talk about their intellectual property. They generally aren't handling it very securely in the first place. And as Jennifer was saying, you could probably just walk in and take it, you know, the printout sitting on someone's desk. So cyber isn't really the risk. But each path brings different things to this, right?
A big part of the problem is you have to do your work. And what we see increasingly is the attempt to use security as a cudgel and to sort of force people to not be able to get their work done without going through too many steps, at which point the people try to circumvent the system and do so successfully.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, getting the job done is the purpose of you being there. You know, being secure is not your purpose. Right.
And by definition, you're successful at doing that job, you know, and bypassing those security rules, because otherwise you would have been fired and replaced with somebody who is. Right. You know, so, right. The path through the grass, you know, the sidewalk goes this way and the path through the grass goes that way, because that's the way people are actually going. But again, right. You know, it sounds cliche to say this, but you know, you hear this all the time. I want to be secure. Okay.
No. Like,
how secure for what? Who are you? What do you want to do? Each of these cases, look, the Coca-Cola secret sauce, you know, that's serious intellectual property. Exactly how that works. You just handle that correctly. You know,
you do not want to be secure unless you're suicidal. If you commit suicide, you're secure, right?
I'll give everybody a classic one. You know, everybody worries about this one. Competitive information, my competitors. 99% of the time, you could dump all of my competitors' current documents on me, and I wouldn't care. I've got enough problems of my own. I mean, knowing your competitors' plans may give you some validation of what you're doing, but, you know, competitors' customer lists, right? I've had, you know, debates with partners about this in the past. It's like, if I had a competitor's customer list, I would mostly know who not to bother calling. I don't know. You know, it's not as valuable as you'd think.
Well, so there are some very valuable pieces of information, and there are examples where businesses have been really dramatically damaged. One of the interesting ones is the cost and price list, right? So if you can underbid your competitor by a teeny bit in a competitive bid, you win the contract. And if you know what their costs are, you can negotiate your costs down to where you're getting the same advantages as they're getting. So those things are, in fact, you know, very valuable in the competitive sense, right? And then you have, you know, national secrets, which are, you know, a whole different world of this stuff. But the thing about listening to Jennifer that I love to hear it is that could be you telling the story or me telling the story or anybody else in the field telling the story, you know, and it says, but she's the one that was there. She's the one that did it. Right. And I think people who are not in the field, who haven't lived the life, you know, it sounds like we're in the mafia here. People haven't lived the life and haven't experienced this stuff. They don't know it. And so hearing those stories, having them tell those stories, some listeners out there are probably saying, oh my goodness. But you know, you and I are saying, yawn. Yep. Okay. Well, what's the biggest amount you got? 4 billion. Okay. What you mean to lose or to take? So, whichever you like, it's fine with me.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Next week on the Cyber Show, Roger talks about medicine without politics.
Jennifer outruns you and the bear. A new mystery guest starts at the beginning, but to what end? A Santa Fe pitcher gets in the middle of a biologic. More fraud, spies, and lies, and a whole lot more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string-beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.